Hola, Su. So now we come to the beginning of the cycle, once again for shamatha. And it strikes me once again that there's really quite an extraordinary symmetry, complementarity, between the way we're starting off with the four measurables, which is a very classic way. I mean, these four questions, okay, I introduced that, but they're completely in accordance with Buddhism. There's nothing alien there. It's just, strategy, format is novel. Content is completely traditional. But we are well familiar with how, with the cultivation of the four measurables, we start off in sequence, because there's a very meaningful sequence, loving kindness, compassion, and so forth. But as Buddha himself recommended, in the cultivation of loving kindness, we start with ourselves. Direct quote from the Buddha, one who loves himself, it's gender neutral, by the way, one who loves oneself will never harm another. Very interesting, almost like a koan. But I'm utterly convinced it's true. And so to start off in that way, and especially as we started off this morning, that is really embedding this sense of loving kindness for oneself in one's vision, as these are fourfold vision quest. What is your vision of genuine happiness? By whatever name, eudaimonia, call it what you will. What is your vision? And then the other three questions. That this is really, to my mind, is a marvelous way to set one's motivation, to set one's motivation for the practice, and with this sense of love, not sternness, not just discipline, and so forth and so on, but a sense of loving kindness to oneself, that's the motivation for venturing onto the path, for engaging in practice. But again, on that delicious culminating note, the final question, and that is, as we develop this loving kindness for ourselves, then as we go deeper, it simply has to embrace others, because we don't exist in isolation. So the notion of striving for our own well-being, but never mind everybody else, is just to starve to death, you know, because you're isolated. You'll just perish. And so that final note, yes, in order for my own fulfillment, what can I offer to others? As Shantideva says, if you don't reflect, don't strive for bodhicitta for your own sake, then how would you ever strive for it for the sake of others? Same theme. So, of course, what this loving kindness directed towards ourselves does is it acts as a direct antidote for something that may have been lingering, almost like a virus that never really caught on until maybe, who knows, I don't know exactly when, but modern era, the virus of self-loathing, self-contempt, low self-esteem, self-hatred. We have so many words for it. Eskimos have word for snow. We have words for this. There must be a lot of it around. You know? Yeah. I mean, why do we have so many words, for heaven's sakes? And you can't translate any of them into Tibetan. I wonder how many words the Arabs have for snow, the ones that live in Saudi Arabia in particular. I wonder how many words for snow. Maybe stuff we don't have? I don't know. I don't speak Arabic. But clearly, if that is an issue, if this is a real strain, almost like a viral infection that one carries, if this isn't remedied, if this is not healed, and I don't mean suppressed, if this isn't healed, it's really hard for me to imagine how the four measurables will really ever take off, or how they'll ever blossom. If there's kind of a self-loathing, a low self-esteem, self-contempt directed inwardly, how is that not going to affect every other relationship? I don't know how that could be possible, right? And so, establishing a sound foundation, a reality-based foundation in motivation, in intention, utterly crucial. And then we come to the shamatha side, and we hear, here's the foundation. I embrace it with all my heart and soul, straight from Padmasambhava, but it crops up a lot in Tibetan Buddhism. I found it mostly in the Nyingma tradition, but I can't imagine it's confined to that. There's nothing sectarian about it. And that is the settling of body, speech, and mind in a natural state. And each one, I want to emphasize this, each one is a matter of balance. It's not just, can you get really relaxed? Can you get really relaxed? Can you get, okay, I'm really relaxed. Now I'm ready to go. Not just relax. If you want relaxation, take Valium. You know, get a massage or get drunk. I don't know. However you want to get relaxed. But you don't need to meditate to get relaxed. Drugs would do it. I'm sure there are drugs that must just hit the, you know, the parts of the brain that will make you go, ew, like that. But that's not what it's about. It's balance. And I don't know any drug at all. This is not putting down pharmaceutical industry. I'm just telling you, I don't know of any drug that can provide you with mental balance. You know, from normal up to exceptional. I don't know of any drug. Maybe there is one. Maybe one day. But right now, I don't know of any. But we do happily have methods for settling the body in its natural state. So there you are, as loose and soft as a marshmallow, and yet you're maintaining that vigilance, right? So it's not uptight, it's not marshmallow, gooey, soft, flaking out. It's that balance in between, sustained with stillness. It goes with the settling of the speech, the inner speech, the respiration and natural rhythm. Again, a matter of balance, of not sucking it in, not blowing it out, not doing anything, let it be, right? And likewise for the mind, you know it well. Relaxation, stability, vividness, there it is. But it's balance all the way through. And right in the middle there, settling respiration in its natural rhythm. If you don't master that one, if you don't not only master it but get accustomed to it, I can pretty much guarantee all your other meditations on top of that won't work out very well. Because your respiration is going to be out of whack. That's going to throw your prana system out of whack. That's going to set your mind out of whack. Out of whack means a state of imbalance, dysfunctionality. So whether you're practicing the highest stage, you know, six yogas of Naropa or Dzogchen or what have you, if you're bringing a dysfunctional prana system, mind, that's not balanced, I can't imagine how any of those are going to turn out well. And I've seen many, many cases where people will meditate. I know people like this, and I say only with sympathy. Meditating with, you know, integrity and discipline and so forth for 40 years, I've seen it repeatedly. 30, 40 years, never learned how to breathe, never learned how to relax or settle body, speech, and mind in a natural state. They never heard it or skipped it. Going into all these practices, sadhanas, mantra recitation, discursive meditations, this, that, and the other thing, and never learned how to just unwind and just tight. Decades of habituation is just being tight, tight. And that can be physiologically tight, but it can also be ideologically or conceptually tight. You know, just rigid, impervious, getting upset when everyone hears something one doesn't agree with. Like, oh, can you relax? Can you set your mind at ease? Can you hear something you don't agree with and say, ah, I don't agree with that, and be easy, and not, freaking out, you know? So there's a balance. There's a balance for all of shamatha. Shamatha there's a balance that is a basis for shamatha. Shamatha, the basis for vipassana. Both of those, the basis for bodhicitta. Those three, the basis for vajrayana and dzogchen and all of that. So we're establishing a foundation here that has a symmetry to it. Really so much of a symmetry. Because if you don't have this, all the other ones will collapse. It's a foundation of sand. If you don't have that loving kindness for yourself and this openness, as we have explored in the meditation, then I don't know how the heart ever opens without it opening within. Right? So there it is. So I went into worldview this morning, and I watched very closely my motivation, and I can say I was happy all the way through. That was not negativity. It was not beating up anybody. It was from my perspective, and I think I know my mind, so I'm going to be really bold here and say, I think I know my mind better than anybody else in this room. I watch it closely for decades now. I think it was fine. I think it was fine. And what I was getting at there is, let's look at the theme of path briefly, but in terms of the absolute core of the Buddhist teachings in all schools, and that is the Eightfold Noble Path and how they map onto the three higher trainings. It's very useful. It's very, very useful. So among the Eightfold Noble Path, we have right or authentic action. What are we doing with our bodies? Right or authentic speech. Is our speech appropriate? Is it true? Is it authentic? And then livelihood. How do we make a living? That is that authentic, reality-based, not injurious, right? Those three of the Eightfold Noble Path, authentic action, speech, and livelihood, those fit into the category of ethics, the first of the three higher trainings. And then within the category of samadhi, the higher training of samadhi, there's authentic mindfulness. Authentic mindfulness. And authentic mindfulness, unlike simply the mental factor of mindfulness, authentic mindfulness means it's really part of the path. It's mindfulness called into the service of proceeding along a path of liberation, of radical, irreversible healing. So it's a very specific type of mindfulness to be cultivated. Samma sati, authentic mindfulness, as opposed to just sati. Sati could be, we can be mindful of all kinds of things. It may be wholesome, unwholesome, or indifferent. But samma sati, authentic mindfulness, that's virtuous. That's virtuous. Right? So there's one. This is in the service of samadhi. This is the classic Buddhist teaching. And then there's authentic effort. Not too much, not too little, the right kind of effort. That's in there. And then there's concentration itself, the unification, the single-pointedness of attention, authentic, that it's reality-based, wholesome motivation. So those three in the service of samadhi, when it finally comes to wisdom, the higher training in wisdom, prajna, then there are just two left over. We've covered six, three plus three, and now we have two left over. And this is why I elaborated as I did this morning. Okay, I want to strike a balance. I'm trying every single day to do that. So for some people, it's bound to be balanced, others not. But I might be able to please all of you some of the time, and I might be able to please some of you all the time. But there is absolutely no chance that I'm going to please all of you all the time. If Abraham Lincoln can't do it, and the Buddha can't do it, then forget about me, hopeless. So if you were thinking I'm going to please you every day in every way, oh, big disappointment. Probably already occurred. So, out of the Eightfold Noble Path, what is serving the cultivation of this higher training and wisdom? It's authentic view, too. And one of them is authentic view. Authentic view. How are you viewing reality? And the Buddhist teachings were designed to challenge our assumptions, not to dodge them, detour around them, say, never mind, it's just beliefs, what do they matter anyway? They matter an awful lot, that's what they matter. Whatever your beliefs are. If they're authentic, that will guide you well. If they're inauthentic, if they're based on falsity, delusion, mere assumption, the smoke of opinion, oh, your views, your beliefs have an enormous impact. That's true for all of us. Whatever your beliefs may be, they will have an impact. Count on it. And so having an authentic view, that's in the service of wisdom, and that's why I spoke at some length about view this morning. And then secondly, and then we conclude, that is within this category of wisdom, the ones left over used to be translated as right thought. And that's not a good translation, and I think it's widely recognized right now. It's authentic intention. It's sambayanda in Tibetan. Authentic intention. Well, we're right back to motivation. Is it reality-based? Is it in accordance with reality? That which inspires you, which impels you, draws you into practice, continues, motivates you to continue in practice. Is it reality-based or is it not? How large is your motivation? Is it confined to your own well-being? Does it embrace those around you? How large is it in space and time? So Buddhist practice from the time of the Buddha is not just to teach us meditation techniques. He was not a lab technician. I'm not a lab technician. Just to teach you, you know, tweak your posture here and tweak your breathing there and tweak your technique there. I'm not a technician. And I'm not training people to become technicians. I'm a Dharma teacher. It's called acharya in Sanskrit. I'm an acharya. It's a Dharma teacher. And acharya means not just one who's transmitting information, because that you can get from a tape recorder, but one who's seeking to teach also by the way of one's own conduct, and that is seeks to walk the walk as one talks the talk. And I will tell you, I seek to do that every day. Sometimes not so well, but not for want of trying. I'm trying. So there we are. And so when we bring in issues of motivation, it has to do with values. What do you value? That's what you will desire. That's what you shall intend. And we see how closely that is coupled with view. How do you view reality? What do you view to be real? And what do you view to be not real? Illusory, epiphenomenal, fantastic. Right? These two, we can see, are closely intertwined. How you view reality is bound to have an impact on your values and therefore your intentions. Okay? So this is why I lingered this morning. Now, having said that, time and time again, we have, 4.5 weeks left, maybe a little bit less now. I'm bound to repeat myself sometimes. And without remorse. No remorse at all. If people could remember everything I say the first time, then I would talk much less. Because I really prefer silence over talking. That's why I spend hardly any time outside of my room. Because I like to meditate there about 10 hours a day these days. Pretty regularly. Average is 10 hours a day. That's what I love to do more than anything else. That's one great attraction for me to come here. Right? But when it comes to view, if we were a, say, some kind of a barbarian civilization, they had no written language, no views, no philosophy, no history, no culture, just a bunch of, you know, primitive people. And the Buddha Dhamma came in, we could just kind of open up and say, okay, give me a view, I don't have one. You know, and I've got one, you know? But that's not even remotely true. That was not true in China. When Buddha Dhamma went from India to China, China was already a very well-developed civilization. Vast literature, Taoism was developed, Confucianism was developed, philosophy, poetry, music, it was a very rich culture before Buddha Dhamma came in. So that was a major issue of bringing something from outside, where this was the Middle Kingdom, this is the center of the earth, this is the one great civilization of the planet as far as the Chinese were concerned. And that was also true of the Greeks and so forth and so on. Generally people think they're the center. But it was quite a big deal. There was a lot of accommodation, a lot of going back and forth when Bodhidharma and later teachers brought Bodhidharma in, that it was coming into a very rich cultural milieu. So there had to be a lot of dialogue, a lot of working through, assimilation, right? So one of these, and I think it's quite delicious actually, is that I've heard even in recent times that in China before the Cultural Revolution and the great tragedy of China of the 20th century, a number of Chinese would say that when it comes to taking care of my body, health, and longevity, I'm a Taoist, because I'm really good at that. When it comes to my social interactions, engagement with politics, family, society, all of my responsibilities in the world, I'm a Confucianist, because he was a really wise guy. He had a lot to say about that, a lot of wisdom, right? And when it comes to liberation and enlightenment, I'm a Buddhist. So they kind of worked it out. I'm obviously not saying that was true for everybody, but I get the rationale of that. That was an assimilation. Okay, we'll give you this, but we're keeping this. We'll give you this, but we're keeping this. Well, we're not China 1,500 years ago, 2,000 years. We're not China. We're modernity. And we're also not a barbaric, but we're not a barbaric civilization. Tremendous literature, philosophy, multiple religions, science, and so forth and so on. So this is not going to be an easy fit. Just, oh, come on in Buddhism. Oh, sure, everything you're saying just sounds fine to me. Yeah, well, now we're Buddhist. That's going to be really rare, right? Because we already have education. Almost every Westerner who comes to Buddhism already has at least high school education, college, doctorate, postdoctorate, whatever. We're pretty overall. We're kind of a sophisticated group, relatively speaking, in history. And so as we engage, there are bound to be points of conflict, of friction, of questioning, of downright, are you kidding me? And others that just slip in easily. And so this is why I keep on coming back to the West, to modernity. It's not to show that Buddhism is better, certainly not in all respects. In some ways it is better. It's much deeper insight. But this is more like the Taoist, Confucianist, Buddhist thing. As this Honen Dalai Lama said when he was in Santa Barbara a few years back, he said, you know, when it comes to the physical world, I really rely on science. You people really know what's going on, you know, for physics, chemistry, biology. And then he said, frankly, and I quote him, when it comes to the mind, you folks are still in kindergarten. He doesn't say that very often. But this is a 2,500-year-old tradition of rational and experiential probing insight into the nature of the mind, the only one you can actually observe, which is introspective, it's pretty formidable. And Western science of mind is 135 years old, and it's primarily looking at behavior and brain. So it's not to put it down. And when you say somebody's in kindergarten, it doesn't mean, oh boy, you stupid. It just means that from our perspective, you haven't developed very far. And now you can disagree with him. If you don't like that statement, that's fine. But I just quoted something he said. If you don't like it, that's cool. Right? So then relax. And if you're like me, you're really relaxed. Because I think, man, you got that one spot on. So this is why, you know, I'm bringing in these themes. The difference between scientific materialism and science. As the Dalai Lama said so many times, if the scientific community can show us empirical evidence, compelling evidence, that any assertion in Buddhism whatsoever is wrong, here's the evidence. He said, we throw out the Buddhist view. We throw out the Buddhist belief. And we say, thank you. We don't say, oh, shucks, you beat me. No, we're after truth here, right? So thank you. Because that's what we wanted. The greatest scientists, people like Richard Feynman, Nobel laureate, great physicist, he said, we scientists, we look especially on those areas. We especially probe into those aspects of the natural world that could prove our theories wrong, because that's how we progress the fastest. Not by dodging them, detouring them. Oh, I don't want to look at that. That's what a dogmatist does. But a really great scientist, like a Richard Feynman, he said, oh, you got something that could challenge my deepest assumptions? Tell me more. Let me investigate. Maybe I can get a grant. You know, that's good science. That's good Buddhism, right? And so whether it's evidence, whether it's contemplative evidence, coming from your own experience, first person, maybe that can refute some assumptions in modern science. Why not? And likewise, scientific evidence, third-person evidence, maybe that can refute some things in Buddhism. Why not? We're after truth here, because it's the truth that sets you free and not simply adopting a bunch of beliefs, materialistic, Buddhist, Christian, or what have you. It's not a bunch of beliefs that set you free. It's knowing the truth as it is. So that's it. That's it. So this morning, I'm sure I repeated some, but if you were listening closely, there was a lot there that was not repetition, that was enormously pertinent to authentic view and authentic intention within the Eightfold Noble Path pertaining to the cultivation of loving kindness and overall motivation for practice. That's why I dwelt, kept you in longer this morning. That's why. It's not just because I like to talk. You know? I have better things to do, like be quiet. Right? And likewise, when I'm attending to, responding to your questions in a public setting, I'm happy to do so every single time, whatever the question is. If it's sincere, I'm happy to respond. And I don't think there was ever an insincere question. But as I do that, as I'm responding to one person, for other people, you may be thinking, this is irrelevant to me. I outgrew that a long time ago. And that's where, once again, we strike a balance, right? That each of us here, 40 of us or so, we're here in our own individual retreat, came here to practice internally, cultivate our hearts and minds, in our own rooms. Yes. And we're also here as a community. So this means sometimes when I'm responding to a question, you say, oh, this is boring. I've heard this so many times. Why do you have to repeat that? Because this person may need to hear it. That's why. So relax. Relax. You hear it again. So it's boring. Big deal. Settle your mind in its natural state. Be happy. Right? So in terms of responding to people's practical questions about their own experience, you're going to hear me repeat more. You may actually hear the word relaxation again. It could happen. Stranger things have happened. You know? Yeah? So in either case, striking this balance, that here we're here as a community. It's a transient community. A transient community. You know? We're here just for a little while. And then like having a cage full of doves, then we'll just, on June 1st, just go in all different directions. And it'll be over. And this will be a memory. You know? But here we are now as a community. And there are people I know around the world, because they keep on writing to me, listening in. Some of them in retreat, quite a number of in retreat, other ones just listening in, and they're very much part of our community also. So when I'm responding to one person here, there'll be some hundreds of people elsewhere listening in, and maybe they're getting benefit, right? And the talk this morning, some people probably didn't find helpful. That's okay. That's okay. But I know for a fact that other people find it helpful. So then relax. This is where we're part of a community, right? That's that. So now, with fewer words, let's get really good at settling body, speech, and mind into natural state. The bell is a reminder of loving kindness. A time to set your body, speech, and mind at ease. To let go of all that troubles you. Let go of the tension in the body. The contractions around the mental Babylon. The tightness of the mind. Set your body at ease. And let the stillness of your body sustain the balance of relaxation and vigilance. Surrender all control over the breath. Without holding it or expelling it. Let the body breathe without intervention. And with every out-breath, settle your inner voice, the conversation of the mind. By releasing the energy behind it, let your inner voice come to rest in effortless silence. Allow yourself the freedom, just for this short time, as a deliberate act of will, to release all attachment to the future and the past. And without grasping, let your awareness come and rest in stillness in the present moment. Now gently constrain this wild steed of your attention within the field of your body, like a wild horse. Keep it within this pasture. Within the field of the body, let your attention roam at will. Contain chaos if you like, letting it roam about the abdomen, the chest, the thighs, the nostrils. Keep your attention in the present moment, within the body, Now maintain a flow of knowing. This is not just to relax, to become peaceful or spaced out. Maintain a flow of knowing. When you breathe in long, note that you breathe in long. Know this. And when you breathe out long, know that you breathe out long. Know this. As you attend to the sensations of the respiration. And when you breathe in short, know that you breathe in short. When you breathe out short, know that you breathe out short. Sustain this balance, especially with every out-breath, of relaxing more and more deeply, releasing tension in the body, releasing the breath, releasing thoughts with every exhalation, but without losing the clarity with which you began, without relinquishing or letting fade out your sense of knowing, of being cognizant, and know the duration of each in and out breath, just that much, and strike the balance of relaxation while maintaining the initial clarity. periodically employ your faculty of introspection to monitor your posture, to see that you're still sitting in a posture of vigilance, that your head is not drooping forward or to the side or flipping backwards. Straight up, supported by your spine, your belly loosed, relaxed, expanding with each inhalation. With introspection, monitor your respiration to see that it is not forced, either forced out or in, but flows effortlessly. And monitor, finally, the flow of mindfulness, noting as quickly as you can when you've been carried away by thoughts or other distractions. And once you note this, relax, release, and return. And with your faculty of introspection, if you see you're just spacing out, just sitting without knowing much of anything, you become nebulous. You've fallen into dullness. To arouse your interest, focus clearly, attend now. This is not a time for flaking out, it's a time for balance. So take an interest in the practice and restore your knowing, your flow of awareness, attention to the duration of each in and out breath. And let's continue practicing now in silence. Hola, Sue. We've had a fair amount of theory the last couple of days, so what I'd like to do now for this session is to focus entirely on practice and the practices we're doing right now and the experiences arising from it, because that's our very precious time. This time will be finished, and we can always read books later, but now's the time for practice in this wonderful setting. So what I'd like to do here is I'm going to be choosing right hemisphere, left hemisphere, but just kind of just choosing and drawing on people whose hands haven't been up for a while. Okay? So I'm going to start with the right. Any hands coming up? Bruce, go ahead.
A practice question.
Very good.
One of my main intentions is to be able to let the flow of my practices go through the whole day here on retreat. So I've worked at that in various ways and having some success, but we talked about this just a little bit earlier on in regards to the kind of focus and stillness that's required in shamatha practice. And I'm thinking now just of the basics of the breath and settling the mind and awareness of awareness. So if you could just maybe say some more about that. There's the activities of eating, of taking a walk, of being in the bathroom, of all the other things we do in between. And I find it a really fascinating exploration how to bring settling the mind, for example, when I'm out taking a walk. Is that possible? Mm-hmm. It seems like it is to me. And as you've said a few times, the Vipassana tradition is pretty good at this.
I would go one notch higher. I think it's very good.
Yeah, since that's some of my training, I'm interested in hope that I'm on the right track in my application of the shamatha instructions that you're giving us in these other situations other than formal sitting. Mm-hmm. And there's also that time in between sitting. I don't know what people do in terms of sitting, you say, 8 or 10 hours a day. Well, for me, when I start counting it up, it's like, well, it really just flows. Are those hours that I'm actually on my cushion?
Yeah.
But I'm a physical person, so I'll sit for 40 minutes, but then I like to get up and walk.
Sure.
Which is also, again, the Vipassana tradition.
Very much so.
And I consider that just as much meditation as on my cushion. So.
Yeah.
Whatever you can add to this.
Sure, sure. Thank you. The whole issue of reckoning hours, it can be helpful in the sense of giving confidence and satisfaction. Not, oh, I've achieved this, or now I'm better, or anything like that. It's just kind of having that sense of conscientiousness, of commitment, of dedication, to the practice. But then how you count the hours, of course, is entirely up to every individual. I really don't care one way or another. If one finds it helpful to kind of keep a tab on the hours of formal practice, might that reasonably include very mindful walking? Yes, definitely, sure. Absolutely, why not? How about in the supine position? Well, you already know the answer to that, right? How about standing? Well, now we've just covered the four postures the Buddha spoke of, right? And so if it's good enough for the Buddha, I think it should be good enough for us that we can be formally. And there's a nice, lovely, blurry edges here, right? When you're eating, then it's really important to choose food that you find tasty, but most importantly, that's nutritious, the right amount and so forth, and then masticating well, making sure you're eating properly and so forth. So that's definitely going to call for some attention. Why not? But could that also be very mindfully done? Being very present with the act of eating, and so forth. Of course it can. But I'd like to augment your question with something not asked, but I'm sure it's there in your mind, because I know you a little bit, and that is we're not here just to be mindful, just to develop attention skills. This is a shamatha and four measurables practice. Right? And so that ambience, that sense that when you're in between sessions, when somebody's coming into your field of experience, the people, whenever we set out, whenever we go out the front entrance, they're almost always there, at the front desk. It's not a requirement that you always greet them and so forth, but, if the spirit moves one. But that can be right there an expression of loving kindness, Mudita, they're so gracious, they're so warm, they're so friendly and helpful. Mudita, empathetic joy. And so letting the seasoning the day, that's one of my favorite phrases, seasoning the day with 10 seconds here and 15 seconds there of these kind of surges of like a little whoo of loving kindness comes up, a little whoo of empathetic joy comes up, of compassion comes up. When the time is ripe, then it's compassion. You see somebody struggling and so forth. And of course, equanimity at all times, donglen at all times. You're breathing. Why not just let donglen catch a ride, you know, with breathing? And you can do that, you know, whenever you see anybody riding a motor scooter coming this way in a car. The trucks filled with workers. You must have seen them. They're working hard. It's not easy. They're working hard. And so wishing them well, you know, that their basic hedonic needs are met. That's kind of the first order on the agenda, right? And beyond that, simply a general, an elevation overall of the sense of presence, of mindfulness. And what we're edging out is, as we're developing authentic mindfulness that is reality-based, you know, what we're edging out is inauthentic rumination. And that doesn't mean that we're edging out thought altogether. We're not throwing out baby with bathwater. So sometimes, very clearly, there's time for reflection. Free flow, just letting the thoughts roam. We've even done that in formal meditation. There's a time for what I like to call, I'm sure it's not original, contemplative reading. You know, there's a lot of reading that can be done, hopefully not a whole lot here, but there is reading that can be done in a very kind of slow, reflective, contemplative way, reading a paragraph, weaving it in, reflecting upon it, and choosing, whether it's articles, books, or what have you, that are really nurturing, informative, perhaps even inspiring for the practice here. You know, is that part of practice? Can you count that? If you sit down for an hour and you're reading some excellent book, you know, by somebody who he or she really knows what they're writing about, and you sit down and it's just 100% saturation, you're bringing quality of relaxation, stability and clarity. Stability and not stillness. Bear in mind, stability means continuity also. It doesn't mean just, you know, a deer in the headlights. And so stability means continuity of attention. So could you maintain an ongoing flow of coherent, focused attention as you're reading something and reflecting upon it, nurturing your heart, your mind, your understanding? Is that formal practice? Why not? So in all of these ways, and just seeing that this common theme, the common verb that runs through all of it, is to attend, to watch over, to watch over, to care for and look after. So when we're attending to our own bodies, our own minds, we're doing all of that. When we're attending to others, we're doing that. When we come into the dining hall and there they are, the eye contact, in my experience, I don't think I'm unusual, I think I'm normal, totally ordinary. I walk in, there's eye contact, they always smile. That's not normal. It's very nice. And of course, the smile back, what else could we do? You know, with a sense, smile of gratitude. Thank you. Here we are, we just have to practice Dharma. You did all that work and you even clean up after us. That's really unusual. Okay? Yeah. Anybody on the left side? Yes, we'll go over to Joe first, and then Danny. But I'll probably go to the right first.
Thank you. I've got a question about sustaining imagination or the continuity of imagination in practicing the four immeasurables.
Yeah.
So, for example, when we're practicing, when I'm trying to imagine the cessation of suffering or the causes of suffering, and the causes of suffering, I can imagine, you know, in respect to my loved ones, I can imagine things like them getting some of the things they need, or I can imagine them with a kind of a beatific smile on their face, or the recipient of some kind of mental transmission that alleviates their pain. But two things strike me. One, that these are symptoms rather than the underlying condition that I'm visualizing. And secondly, they're sort of momentary acts. I imagine them and then they're completed. And then my imagination kind of runs out, as it were. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you, how does one, or for example, how do you sustain imagination on such things? Or do you have any kind of advice about how to achieve continuity in our representation of things?
Yeah, very good. When the word compassion is used in the modern world, and I think it's east, west, everywhere, it tends to be for that is compassion for people, sentient beings, animals, very much included, who are experiencing blatant suffering. They're having a hard time. They're being slaughtered. They're being abused. They're suffering in this way or not. They're getting old. They're getting sick. They're being under political oppression and so forth. They know they're suffering. You attend to them. You know they're suffering. And so we arouse the motivation by attending to that, right? And likewise, when we think of empathetic joy, it's easiest to feel, to bring to mind people who are experiencing, let's call it blatant happiness. Oh, and then rejoicing, you know. You see, as a grandfather, you see your grandchild, and he's often pretty happy. And so easy, kid being happy, very easy, right? But on both sides of the ledger, when we start bringing wisdom to it, then we do attend to the underlying causes. What is the role of attachment? The surface manifestation is, I'm feeling great. How's your life? Great. Couldn't be better. Life is good. And it's all based on attachment. So you can be empathetic. We're not being sourpusses here. Well, I'm not going to rejoice. I'm not going to rejoice in your happiness because yours is based on attachment. Not that, right? We're not going to be elitist here. If a person's enjoying being rich, enjoying being famous, enjoying having really good health, enjoying being attractive. Some people are attractive. They'll get over it, but, you know, for a while. And so if you see somebody obviously really enjoying being happy, I'll tell you a little story if I may. My stepdaughter, who's actually very beautiful herself, and she has a beautiful little son, several years back they were driving along. She was driving, he wasn't. He was four. They're driving along, and she sees on the side of the road a guy jogging. And he's just got his shorts on, and the guy is buff. I mean, he's sleek, body fat down to 3%, whatever. And he's got this perfect tan, just not too dark, not too light, you know. And I'm going to try to give the face. He's pretty digging his body, you know. And he's jogging. He could jog anywhere, but he's jogging right on the side of the road, you know. So here's my beautiful stepdaughter, and she notes him. And, you know, she's very self-contained. And she just saw, here's a handsome young guy being a handsome young guy. There was no lust or anything like that. But she noted this guy, he looks like he's really quite happy with his body. And so she was thinking, maybe I should just pepper the horn. Just to say, I see you. She's very beautiful, you know. And, some beautiful woman just thought, gave me the little beep beep, you know. And as she was thinking that, then her little son, I think about 4 years old at the time, he said, Mama, beep the horn. They have a very strong karmic connection, the two of them. So, and why not? He's healthy, he's young, he's handsome, he's really taking good care of his body, he's exercised well. Enjoy it, you know, enjoy it. At the same time, they're just one of those things, death taxes and that. It ain't going to last. You know, it doesn't. That doesn't last. Death and taxes come. This is going to pass. That's just as certain as the other ones. And so a deeper viewing into the underlying causes, let alone the deepest, you know, when we go to delusion, craving, along with that. So now, to be really practical, but this is practical, what I just said, but the practical for myself, Donglen really works because I keep on breathing. I don't take breaks, you know, for half an hour at a time just when I get bored. Breathing goes whether I'm paying attention to it or not. So the breathing is always there. That's my rhythm, you know. And so in between sessions, since the breath is already happening, it's just so easy. Since it's continuous, then I can just piggyback on the breath and practice Donglen. And so when I go out for my evening walk, that's part of my formal meditation. If I'm with somebody, then I'm talking, and that's my practice there too, be talking and try to be of service there. But most of the time, I'm walking alone. That's what I prefer. I'm happy to help, but when nobody needs me at that time, then I'm walking alone. And I'm doing nothing besides practice. And I'm really then attending, because I'm going out there for the four immeasurables in Donglen. If I don't want to practice shamatha, I'm staying in my room. I don't need to walk out for that. Right? Okay? Very good. So I'm going to come back. Danny, you're next in the line on the left side, but we're going to go to the right side. Anything coming up of here? For a hand that's not been up for a while? And if we find one, okay, yes, not for a while. Ian.
Hey. Alan, could you explain the tonglen?
How?
Tonglen.
Yeah.
How does that work?
How does that work? Yeah. That's what we did yesterday afternoon. That was tonglen. But I never really kind of unpacked it as such. I just kind of slipped it right in there, like slipping something into your drink, you know? You were having a nice four-mezhbo cocktail, and I slipped a Mickey in there called the tonglen. Tong means to send, len means to take. It's an Indo-Tibetan practice. The four measurables are all for all Buddhist schools, and they're in the yoga tradition, in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. The four measurables are there. I think they're called something else, but who cares? But exactly those, Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, Upeksha, they're there. So these are clearly, you know, universal virtues. But there we are. So, but in terms of the tonglen, this comes from Indian Buddhism and then just was so embraced and saturated Tibetan Buddhism, all schools, and of course it's an utterly non-sectarian practice. And so what it entails, as you now well know though, really, is attending to suffering on all levels, latent suffering of change, existential suffering, I'll call it, but also very much, as Joe was pointing out, also the causes. And as we attend closely to the point that the other person, person's whole region of the globe, whole species, or people in a phase of life, just attending to the elderly, as I'm attending closely to my parents now who are well under their 80s and seeing that, boy, that's no picnic. That's no picnic. So it's very easy. Now it's, you know, now these are the older people I know best and I've known them for 62 years. Oh, that's what old age is. It gives me more inspiration. I'll practice Dharma now. I'm oldish, but I'm not old that old. So make hay while the sun shines, as they say, yeah? And so whether it's for a whole group of people, whether it's a species, whether it's a place of conflict in the world, as you attend closely and you imagine, insofar as you're able, if we kind of flesh this out a bit, insofar as we're able, and we haven't done this yet, we probably will in the next cycle or this cycle later on, actually expand the imagination and imagine doing a little 180-degree turn so that now you are the other person looking back on you. Imagine being that person from that person's own side. Not viewing them from outside with a lot of empathy, viewing them from the inside, from identity. And of course, we'll fail, but we won't fail 100%. And get some sense, what would it be like to be in that person's skin, with that person's environment, that person's personal history, that person's situation? What would that be like? And trying to feel it, experience it. And then, once you've done that, gotten a little bit of a taste, then you rotate right back again. And then you're practicing, attending to, and as you attend to the suffering and causes, you imagine that symbolically as like a dark cloud, as a darkness, and you siphon this into this orb of light at your heart. And very importantly, you imagine that however much you bring in, even if you attend to the billion-fold world systems, that's what it's called in Buddhism, billion-fold world systems. And there are countless billion-fold world systems. And so a billion-fold, short tangent, but a billion-fold world is a collection of worlds that are inhabited. So if you just have like the moon, if there are no sentient beings on the moon, and that's my working hypothesis right now, that's not a world system. It's just a rock, a cold and hot rock. But that's not a world. So a world has to have sentient beings on it. And in the Buddhist worldview, there are billion-fold world systems. Sounds kind of like a galaxy. And there are countless of them, right? And so as we attend, so you may attend to sentient beings throughout the world, for, you know, as expansive as space itself. That's one of the phrases that comes up. Sentient beings throughout the whole entirety of expansive space. And then imagine drawing in all the suffering. Okay, that's going to be a bit abstract, but nevertheless, that is a practice. But however much darkness you pull in, crucial element of the practice is that you imagine the orb of light at your heart is greater. And a nice analogy is it would be like taking a down feather, like from a goose, you know, a down feather, and dropping that into a flame, into a bonfire. Drop it. And it's just gone. You know, you don't even see you don't even see the ashes. That's gone. You know? And so you imagine all that darkness coming in, and then it's gone. It's gone because this was infinitely greater. Infinitely greater. And then as you breathe out, again to one single individual, to a community, to an age group, to people in hospitals, and so forth and so on, then again, as you're breathing out this light from your heart, of course with the aspiration of loving kindness, once again it's crucial that you are drawing on an inexhaustible reservoir. That however much you breathe out this light of loving kindness, it's no less at the end. It's no less. Infinite capacity. And so in that way, one can attend just from person to person, or let the focus of awareness be very, very broad, but it's drawing in, breathing out. And that really is the synthesis, I think, as you've already intuited. That's the synthesis of all the four measures and a very core bodhisattva practice. Okay? Good. Hola, so Danny, you're on. Have to give Alma the greatest possible exercise. She's getting so fat, you can see.
I would like to share an advice I got with reference to Andrea's question.
Good.
Before I went to the first shamatha retreat, I got from two people the advice, be kind to yourself. And I didn't really know how to read that at the beginning, because I'm also possibly overambitious and try very hard to get somewhere. Every time I remembered being kind to myself, not only did it help me immediately to calm down, but with some time I also found out the subtleness growing. So rather than trying too hard or wanting too much, be kind to yourself and take the patience. That helped me very, very much. My question to you, Alan.
Thank you for the first part.
My question is with regard to shamatha. Is there any natural predisposition in all humans for shamatha? For instance, if I take flow, like I see it in my children when they make music, sports, arts, is that some type of the natural state of our mind when it comes to shamatha?
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Excuse me. I found it very useful to draw a rather sharp distinction between natural and habitual. And so when we speak of settling the mind in its natural state, sem nel du bapa. Sem is mind. Nel is this natural, uncontrived, unforced state. Natural, and bapa means to descend. So we're allowing the mind to descend into a state that is uncontrived, unconfigured, loose, natural. Right? But and I think many people here have some taste of that, some taste of that experience of allowing your awareness or sustaining your awareness in a state of stillness, even while your mind or activities of the mind are in motion. Right? We're getting a little taste there. Of the stillness even in the midst of activity. And that stillness, that non-configuration, that lack of grasping, then is settling into. That is achieving shamatha, and that is settling into the natural state. Right? But then we can say, is that normal? We say natural could be normal. It's just natural to get angry if somebody insults you. It's natural, right? It's normal. It's habitual. So these three words can be used completely interchangeably, right? Well, not here. Not here. So this is the natural state, but it's not normal. It's utterly not normal, and it's not habitual. And so habitually, especially in this modern world with this very fast pace and the multitasking, the many demands on our time, and the enormous amount of information to which we are exposed, this is all very unusual. I think it's important to recognize how unusual our environment, our social environment, technological environment, and so forth is, because this is really quite an extraordinary experiment we're imposing upon ourselves. It's very unusual. Aha. And so what is normal and what is habitual is for the mind to be totally caught up habitually and almost all the time in rumination, except when we get really concentrated. And I heard somebody speak just recently and made a spot on, it was a professor from Stanford, and he had a large group of people in the audience, like 400. And he had some very, very intelligent remarks to make. But the way he started off his lecture was, okay, everybody, I now invite you, turn to 400 people and say, please whip out your cell phones, your smartphones, your iPods, iPads, and so forth, and check your email right now. Very unusual. Check your email right now. Go ahead. And out came 400. And then when he let them do that for a minute or so, he said, okay, now check. You're probably holding your breath. As you're reading your email, I'll bet you're holding your breath. Nice experiment. Well, so we're either ruminating or we're clenching. I'm sure that's not true for every single person, but I think it's probably a pretty good generalization. That when we get focused, when we start working, we start driving, we start really concerted effort, we start really paying attention, that's exactly when we start seizing up, exactly when we start getting depleted, drained, worn out, fatigued, stressed out, right? So those two, ruminating, so you're just caught up in the smog, and then the clenching, the bearing down, the contraction, as we get to work or we get to play or with video games or whatever people are doing, that's normal and it's habitual. But in the midst of all of this, is there, I'll speak a little bit, and it may be a bit sappy, but is there a small voice crying out, give me a break? Would you please give me a break here? As we enclose our minds in self-centeredness in the pig pen veil of dust, of rumination, I, me, mine rumination, is there some other voice there that is just suffering and wants freedom? And so I'll give now, I think what I've said now is what thus far I think is pretty much just true. And I'll say something else I think is just true, but it's now specifically from Buddha's perspective. I'll go back to the statement by the Dalai Lama when he made, I think, utterly a true statement. And I've quoted it before, now briefly. Hypothesis, not dogma, that our fundamental impulse is caring. That which moves us. To raise the hand, put down the hand down, move here, move there, do this, do that. Fundamental impulse, primal, simple. The taproot is caring. We care about suffering and pleasure, happiness. We care. We can't really stop. It's not an optional. It's built in, it's hardwired, it's intrinsic to our very being, sentient beings. Is we can't stop, even people who commit suicide. That's an expression of their caring about themselves, that I want the suffering to stop. This seems to be a good strategy. Even that's an expression of caring. People who torture other people. I've seen one person on video interviewed. He was a professional torturer. He was a Tibetan, actually, from Amdo, but brainwashed by the Chinese communists many, many years ago. But I saw him interviewed in a marvelous film called Compassion in Exile. It's outstanding. I recommend it. But this man was a professional torturer. And what was his motivation for torturing? Caring. He cared. He must have believed deeply in the communist worldview and the whole agenda, and this would be good for Tibet, it would be a good thing. And this is one of the things that needs to be done, just like pulling weeds or whatever, spraying herbicide on your lawn. You know, this is okay, it kills, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing. And so where does that come from? I find this so interesting. This impulse of caring that is indefatigable, relentless. And in the Buddha's worldview, it's forever. It doesn't stop, not at death. Wish it would, kinda. Uh-uh. So where's it coming from? Buddhist answer, Buddha nature. That you will not be at rest. You'll not be at rest. Tell that impulse from your own Buddha nature is allowed to spread its wings. And all that impedes it, the craving, the hostility, the grasping, the rumination, the laxity, the excitation, and so forth, all that cramps, strains, confines, represses the impulse from your Buddha nature. All that confines it, so I only care about these people but not those people. All that confines it, all the barriers, until all those barriers of the heart are broken down, all the barriers of the mind are broken down, until you realize your heart's desire, the voice of your own Buddha nature, pristine awareness. Until then, you'll be dissatisfied, and you should be. Right? So that's natural. That's woven into the very core of reality at the deepest possible level. And when we get out of the way and don't impede that, that impulse of caring then floods our whole lives, our own personal lives, and the spirit of loving kindness directed inwardly. But then we see, oh, this skin is porous. And oh, this mind is porous. And here we are all rising in interdependence with each other, and therefore no impediment. And that flow of caring flows out in all directions. The flow of sanity flows out in all directions. Of clarity and cognizance and inner stillness flows out in all directions. So shamatha, bodhicitta, realization and emptiness, wisdom, flows out in all directions. And that's what Dharma is for. From the outside to cultivate, from the inside to release all that inhibits. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have not heard from James for a while. And let's clock her. 5, 6, 7. Very good.
I'd just like to extend a little bit on Joe's question.
Yeah.
Because I find this is also going to be an extension to Ian's question, because I find I don't necessarily always know what, like, for instance, when I'm practicing Tonglen, I don't always know what it's going to be like for the other person when their suffering is over, you know? Mm-hmm. So I find the image of the shadow being ceased, you know, being dispersed.
Yes,
dissolved.
the dark cloud. Yeah,
I find that really, really useful. Mm-hmm. So you know, like when I'm walking around here, I don't necessarily see a lot of suffering going on around here, but I know, of course, there's levels of suffering that I can't necessarily
Having
see.
Having interviewed everybody individually, I could fill you in a lot,
mm-hmm.
but I won't.
So, you know, I'll go around and I'll ask myself, how does this person suffer? And I'll just assume that there is some suffering, and I'll imagine a cloud, and then I'll bring it into my heart, you know, but I don't want it necessarily to be useless, you know what I mean? So I just assume there's some suffering. I don't necessarily know what it's like, what it is, but I'll make a cloud, and I'll pull it in, but I don't necessarily know what it's going to look like afterwards, and I don't necessarily know what it is, but it's, so it's still kind of vague.
Right. Very good. Yeah. This is why I think it's very helpful right from the very beginning. The very beginning. Love and kindness directed towards yourself. Then now here we have the ringside seat. Do you have a pretty good sense of what causes you to suffer? The body, the mind, and so forth. Do you have a sense of what brings you joy? A sense of satisfaction, gladness? You're probably a world expert. And it's very personal. It's very specific. And it's locked into where you are in your life right now, and your personal history and so forth. So you're really an expert on that. And so to develop loving kindness is to be developing this in a very well-informed way when you direct it towards yourself. Right? So it's very real, very tangible. And one can actually practice Tonglen with respect to oneself. Imagine the darkness of your own suffering and the causes of suffering as kind of, again, the kind of the pig pen dark cloud around you, and then draw it in. And then breathe out and saturate your whole being. So this is classic. You can practice Dongden not only for others, but for yourself. But then to move beyond that, because this is a good place to begin, but not to end, then a way to respond very practically to the valid issue you're raising is to attend, at least for some time, to people whom you know well. Whom you know well. And I'll just leave it at that. You know who they are. Friends, loved ones, people you have a lot of contact with, you've hung out with them a lot, years, maybe decades, or maybe a fairly recent relationship, but a lot of conversation, you feel I've gotten to know this person quite well in a short time. And so in those cases, and once again, you get a pretty good idea. You know, it won't be as nearly as textured, as intricate, and as rich as the person's own experience of their experience, but nevertheless, it's pretty real. It's pretty real. When I think of my parents right now, I don't have to use my imagination much. Kind of suffering they're going through, it's transparent. I think it's hardly kind of no mystery about it at all. I mean, I'm not going to elaborate, that's their private business, but it's just transparent. You know? And then I think, even though my mother and my father both have utterly, of course, unique histories, what they're going through right now, oh boy, they're not alone. They're not alone, well into their 80s. That's going to be really common, exactly the kinds of things they're experiencing now. Almost all their friends are dead. How's yourself? Just for starters, how about that? They outlived almost all of them. And they had a very rich friendship. They traveled all over the world, friends all over the world, a real nucleus of friends. They shared a lot. Their Christian Bible study and really, really rich friendships. They're all dead. How's yourself? For starters, how about that one? And how rare is that for people well into their 80s, that almost all their friends are dead? That's going to be the norm. That's not going to be the exception. Most people don't live that late. So as you venture out then, so it's very real, you know, very real, attending here, attending there. And then as you extend outwards, then it's still very real even though it's common. People dying of cancer or seriously struck by cancer and not knowing whether they'll survive or not. I think there's a lot of commonality in that. I mean, it's studied by psychologists a lot. What are the phases when you see that you have cancer? That's the kind of thing psychologists study. They're very good at it. So it's common. It's common. And so forth. So I think one can attend to some things that are quite unique. At the same time, we share so much. We share so much. And focusing on that shared sense. And especially as in the conversation with Joe, when we tap down to, okay, how many people here, and I'm not asking for a show of hands, but how many people here have experienced suffering because of attachment? You just look at it and you say, there was a phase of my life, well, that was pretty intense. That was a pretty hard time. That was awful. Is this just Buddhist doctrine, or can you, on your own, with your own experience, your own intelligence, can you trace that back to attachment? Say, wow. I wouldn't be surprised if there are no exceptions in the room. You know, each flavor, each manifestation, unique, but there's common ground. Common ground. And so in this way, I think I'll end on this note. You see, what is the common denominator of mental afflictions? Some of them emotions, some of them cognitive, some of them cognitive, having to do with desire. Some attentional. There's attentional imbalances also. All of those, the cognitive, attentional, cognitive, and the affective of emotion, all of these. There are mental afflictions that get into all of these modes, right? And the common denominator is mental afflictions afflict. They don't necessarily feel bad. When your mind is just totally caught up in craving and you think you're going to get it, it feels really good. You know, or you're really enjoying something with intense attachment. It can feel really good. And it's just driven by attachment. You know? Or some people, I think, enjoy being angry in a very self-righteous and indignant way. I have a right to be angry. This person, you know? I think some people get a kick out of that. I've never enjoyed it myself. But I think some people, you know, I think do. I mean, they tell me they do, so I must take them, I think, their face value. But the point here is that mental afflictions afflict. They may feel good, but I'm sure some kind of poisons taste good if you drink them. It's just not so good 10 minutes later, right? And so when we attend to others, maybe manifesting as far as we can tell, this not being judgmental, it's being discerning, it's being intelligent. But when we see on occasion other people apparently manifesting mental afflictions. It's very easy to be judgmental, especially if we're not experiencing the same affliction at that time. Right now, I'm superior to you. That's real easy. That's real easy. Silly. That's like feeling superior to another person who has a cold when you don't. Okay, if that's what turns you on, you know, and it's kind of silly. But when we witness other people who apparently are acting out of mental afflictions, where it's so easy to feel angry, upset, arrogant, condescending, and so forth, just go through the Rolodex of your memory. I go through the Rolodex of my memory. Oh, have I ever experienced that mental affliction? I'm seeing it seems to be manifesting in this person right now. Have I experienced that one? Or is that one just unknown to me? Some foreign virus I've never caught? I think you know the answer to that one. And as we practice engaging these practices, settling the mind, and so forth, as we become very mindful of our bodies, as Bruce was talking about, mindful of the body, mindful of the mind, it just becomes obvious. Mental afflictions hurt. They hurt. Even craving and attachment, if you're attending closely, you see it's throwing off balance. There's an anxiety factor, a tenuous factor, a fragile factor, a vulnerable factor. It's there. If you just look closely, this is not 100% pleasurable. There's something going on here, and it's not pleasurable, if you're attending very closely. And so when we sense that, that delusion, it makes us suffer. Craving makes us suffer. Envy makes us suffer. Arrogance, it's so objectionable. But more importantly than that, it makes us suffer. And of course, anger, it's in our face, like the smack in the jaw. And when we sense that, then when we witness other people experiencing or seeming to manifest mental afflictions, just compassion. It's compassion that comes up. And I'll end with this note from the Dalai Lama. And that is when he has referred so many times, he's had a lot of practice talking about the atrocities in Tibet, his people. And he said, when we witness the suffering, and I've known so many Tibetans who are there, they experienced it. I'm telling you about things I've heard. They tell what they experienced. The Dalai Lama experienced this. It has so much more power when it comes from somebody who actually was there. So relatively little for me. I'm just a secretary, a little relay station, right? But where they can go through that, and then respond from their heart. Let us arouse compassion for those who harmed us, who took our country, the genocide, the murder, the demolition of our culture, the destruction of almost all the monasteries, and the killing of so many monks and nuns, as well as lay people. Let us feel compassion for them. That's the only authentic response, compassion for them. That's Dharma. And it's natural. It's natural because it's true. It's reality-based. That yes, the outer display is you're harming somebody else. The inner is you're brutalizing yourself. When I saw this fellow, this Tibetan fellow from Amdo, maybe 45 years old or so, who had, for some significant portion of his life, he is a professional torturer. And I saw him speak. I'm just normal. I'm nothing special. I couldn't have any experience other than compassion. It looked as his whole presence, the way he spoke, his eyes, facial expression, it looked like somebody had taken a blowtorch to his heart. It looked like he was singed right down to the core. Like somebody killed him while he's still alive. You know. So then what do you experience besides compassion? Nothing else is realistic. We're not being good here. We're not being virtuous. We're just being realistic. How can you attend to that and not feel compassion for this man? He was so savaged by his own behavior. The other people merely died. They're merely victims. They suffered for a while and then they're dead. But he has this lingering while he's still alive. And if he doesn't purify, then there's worse to come. Much worse than what he dispensed to others. And it's compassion all the way around. So, something like that. Yeah. Dharma's good. Dharma's good at the beginning, the middle, and the end. So let's be happy about Dharma.